Have I already talked about this slide? Each of my sections is a little different. Was I on four? Okay, so I didn't even get to four. I did talk about three. Let me just remind you that what the important point here is that for any given ecosystem, there is a flow through of energy, whereas there's a recycling of materials. Energy flows through, comes in as sunlight, gets transferred and transformed, and then leaves as heat. But the materials in the ecosystem just keep getting passed around within the ecosystem. And we can see in slide four the energy coming in as sunlight and then eventually leaving as heat. But along the way, there's several transfers of energy and transformations. A transformation of energy refers to turning it into a different form. For instance, sunlight is radiant energy. But there's chemical energy stored in the bonds of the molecules made by the photosynthetic organisms. So the energy that used to be in sunlight is now in the molecules that those photosynthetic organisms like plants make. That's a transformation because there's a different type of energy. Transfer of energy refers to moving the energy from one object to another, whether it's a living object or a non-living object. So energy moves around and gets transformed, but then eventually leaves as heat. All right, well, that's enough about that. Let's go to five then. This is a slide that represents a closeness or a correspondence between form and function. There's a phrase that's often used, a succinct phrase of that's form fits function. That means how an organism is built, which is its form, suits the function that that body plan, or that I shouldn't say plan, that body form has. The function, whatever a structure functions as, it has the structure because that structure works for doing that job. And that's because of gradual improvement based on evolution by natural selection. Remember, not within a lifetime of an individual. Individuals don't evolve, but over generations, form comes to fit function very closely. And the example here, there's countless examples, but this uses birds as an example, which are not as delicate as we sometimes say they are. The birds that fly, which is most birds, have to tolerate, their skeletons have to tolerate enormous stresses. The flapping of the wings against the atmosphere presents huge forces that need to be withstood in order not for the bones not to break. Well, you could make bones really strong by making them thicker and more and solid, right? But what's the problem with that from the viewpoint of a bird? They're going to be too heavy to get off the ground, exactly. It would require so much force that they wouldn't be able to supply it with their muscles. So instead of having solid bones, birds have pneumatized bones or air-filled bones, like you see in the cutaway view right here. And this is a good example of how natural selection has selected for a structure that does a very good job of functioning the way it's supposed to. If you think about this from a design perspective, which is not what natural selection is, new things pop up just by accident, just by mutation in DNA, which is accidental changes in DNA that correspond to new versions of proteins being produced. Remember, the proteins are the things that give you your traits. Anyway, these random accidents happen, and most of them are just bad, so they get selected against. But every once in a while, you'll have an accident that occurs that produces something that does the job even better than what was before, and those things get selected for. So natural selection improves the fitness over time. But if you think about this as though you were designing, or if you could design this, you know, an engineer could be tasked, for instance, with building some sort of cylinder out of some sort of material, like this cylindrical bone. And if you are told you can do really whatever you want, but you can't go over the limit, here's exactly how much material you get to use, you can't go over that limit, then you could make a rod, right, a solid cylinder, but you would quickly hit the limit of your material, right? And the rod would therefore have to be a pretty small diameter because it's solid. It would use up all your material. And the narrower a cylinder is, the easier it is to bend. Like if you bend this at this angle, bend it right here. In order for that to bend, there has to be on this side compression of material, right? And on this side there has to be expansion of material. Do you see that? Well, the narrower this tube is, the smaller the amount of compression on one side and expansion on the other. And therefore, it's easy to bend, relatively. If you have a large diameter tube bent at the same angle, then this is now a lot of compression here and a lot of expansion there that has to occur. So it resists being bent. Well, if you have only so much material to use, you can achieve a greater diameter simply by making it a hollow tube rather than a solid rod. And that's what natural selection selected for in this example. What was I going to say about that? I guess nothing. Maybe I was done there. Okay, now to six. Change in topic, pretty drastic change in topic in this introductory chapter. We're looking at two cells here, one much larger than the other. But the fact that there are two cells here represents a dichotomy of cell types. Now, dichotomy literally means cut in two. The tomy part means cut. But a dichotomy is simply a two-part way of looking at something. And in terms of cell types, in all of biology, there's two major types of cells, two categories. And we call those prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. Now notice that these words share this karyo part, which comes from a root that means kernel or core, the important center, in other words. Well, that core root or kernel root really for a cell refers to a cell nucleus, if the cell has one. Yeah, the nucleus, in other words, is like the kernel or the core of a cell that has one. And so that's the basis linguistically for these two words. Pro means before. And eu means good or true. So prokaryotic literally means before the nucleus existed evolutionarily. Not all cells have nuclei, and the original cells didn't have one. That's actually much later in the history of life until the first cells with nuclei came on the scene. They evolved from the cells that didn't have nuclei. The prokaryotic cells were the only things that existed for a while. Now we have both prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. So that's the basis for the linguistic distinction of the words. They mean prokaryotic cell means without a nucleus, and eukaryotic cell means with a nucleus. That's true for these two types of cells. Prokaryotic cells do not have a cell nucleus, and eukaryotic cells do. But that's not the only difference. That's just the basis for those names. Before I get to the other differences, though, let me just tell you that a nucleus, a cell nucleus, and I usually won't say cell nucleus, but I just want you to realize we're also going to be talking about atomic nucleus, which is a totally different thing. But the nucleus of a cell is an example of an organelle, which, remember, is one of those levels in the hierarchical hierarchical arrangement of biological organization that we looked at the last time, right? Atoms to molecules to organelles. Organelles is a level. Well, there's all kinds of different organelles, and the nucleus is one of them, but more specifically than saying that it's an organelle, we can say that it is a membrane-bounded organelle. And I want to alert you of the fact that there's two very similar but different phrases. Membrane-bounded is not the same thing as membrane-bound. They're both used in biology and sometimes incorrectly, unfortunately. But membrane-bounded uses the word bounded, which is the past tense of bound. To bound something means to form a boundary with, to form an edge. So membrane-bounded means enclosed by a membrane. And that's what we're talking about here. A nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle because it has its own membrane covering it. Membrane-bound, I'll talk about later, that is a totally different phrase. That word bound in membrane-bound is itself a past tense of bind, to tie or to connect to, right? So later we'll talk about membrane-bound proteins, for instance. A membrane-bound protein is not enclosed by a membrane. It is part of a membrane because it's tied to it. It is bound to the membrane. You see what I'm saying there? So I'll get back to that when we talk about proteins later, but a nucleus is just one example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And eukaryotic cells have them. Prokaryotic cells do not. That's the basis for the distinction of these two names. That's not the only difference, though, as I said. Well, not only does a eukaryotic cell have a membrane-bounded organelle called the nucleus, it also has other membrane-bounded organelles. And we'll survey those in a different chapter, things like the endoplasmic reticulum or chloroplast, whatnot. You might have heard of those before. Those are examples of membrane-bounded organelles. You find membrane-bounded organelles only in eukaryotic cells. So yes, it's true that a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus, but it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. And the reason that's a big deal is because the presence of membrane-bounded organelles subdivides or compartmentalizes the cell. The cell itself is defined by a membrane also, by the way. Every single cell, by definition of being a cell, has an outer boundary made up of membrane material, and we call that membrane the plasma membrane. Or some books call it the cell membrane, but plasma membrane is correct name for it. So every cell, prokaryotic or eukaryotic, has a plasma membrane. That's the edge of the cell, the boundary between the cell and the rest of the universe. But for a prokaryotic cell, that's the only membrane the cell has. The plasma membrane is it. And therefore, you can see a prokaryotic cell here in the figure. Therefore, the cell, the overall prokaryotic cell, has just one compartment. The general interior is the only compartment it has, right? And all of the stuff that you find in that compartment collectively is called the cytoplasm. Cyte means cell, plasm means stuff. So it's well named the cell stuff. Everything inside the plasma membrane in a prokaryotic cell is the cytoplasm. A eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, is not just one compartment. It has its own plasma membrane, but there are also subcellular structures, these membrane-bounded organelles, that have their own interior, right? Each membrane-bounded organelle is like a little chamber within the big chamber called the cell. And we see that in the bigger cell here, which is the eukaryotic cell. The purple thing is the nucleus, and it has its own membrane by virtue of being a membrane-bounded organelle. We call that membrane, by the way, the nuclear envelope. And we'll study it later when we look at all the organelles in detail. But the point here is that the membrane, the nuclear envelope, subdivides this general interior of the cell into multiple compartments. And the stuff that's inside the nucleus is different and in a different compartment compared to the stuff that's outside of it but still in the cell. And that's why we don't say everything in a eukaryotic cell collectively is called the cytoplasm, like for a prokaryotic cell. The stuff that's inside the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell is called nucleoplasm, the stuff of the nucleus. The cytoplasm, which a eukaryotic cell also has, is the stuff that's outside of the nucleus but still inside the cell. Okay, so the brownish or the tan background here is the nucleus or is the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic cell. You can also see that just in general there's a range in sizes for cells, but in general a prokaryotic cell is roughly 1/10 of the size of a eukaryotic cell in each of the three dimensions. So 1/10 is wide, 1/10 is long, 1/10 is tall. And therefore, in terms of volume, it's 10 times 10 times 10, or 1,000 times bigger for a eukaryotic cell, the volume, compared to a prokaryotic cell. And this is why it can be true. I don't remember whether I told you this last time or not, but your body is made up of 100 trillion cells, but for every one of your own cells, which has your own DNA in it, there's 10 to 100 bacteria living in and on you. Well, they're much smaller, so they can outnumber your cells pretty easily. Prokaryotic, by the way, these words, prokaryotic and eukaryotic, are adjectives, but we can also make them into nouns to denote organisms that have these types of cells. A prokaryote, or is just a shorthand way of saying a prokaryotic organism. Prokaryote, and similarly for eukaryotes, we are eukaryotes. Prokaryotes are unicellular. So each prokaryote has just one cell. Eukaryotes can be either unicellular or multicellular. We obviously are multicellular examples of eukaryotes. And by the way, the fact, for instance, in mammals, we're mammals, more specifically than saying that we're animals, at maturity, our red blood cells do not have nuclei. But that doesn't make that red blood cell a prokaryotic cell. It actually starts out in its development with a nucleus, and then it gets rid of it so that it can pack more hemoglobin into it. So that doesn't qualify it as a prokaryotic cell. The vast majority of our cells have a nucleus, but that's just an exception that is still a eukaryotic origin. Prokaryotes never had a nucleus to begin with. Yeah, that's all I want to say about that figure. Let's go on to 7. Yeah, go ahead.
Did we skip 4?
No, 4 is where I started. I only said a few sentences about 4. That was the continuation of that, of the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, so now we're on 7, and remember what I said is an important thing that cell theory tells us? Right. Cells come from pre-existing cells. They don't just pop into existence, at least not anymore. And I haven't, not since the original successful cells. And, usually How that happens is by cell division. This is how you became multicellular. You're not just a huge zygote, one human body sized cell. Instead, you're made up of many, many cells that started out as one cell, and then that zygote split into two. Each of those then split into two. So cell division destroys one cell, or it gets rid of that cell, it no longer exists, and gets replaced by two cells, right? Those two cells that come into existence, though, sprang from a cell that already existed before it. That's how things usually happen. That's cell proliferation, the addition of new cells by splitting. What we see here is the creation of the zygote that you started with as, But that's kind of an exception. Instead of a cell splitting, you have cell fusion. Two gametes, which is the general word for sex cells. A sperm is a gamete from a male, and egg is a gamete from a female. Those cells actually fuse together to form one cell, the zygote. That's the beginning of you. But even though that's an exception to cell division, it's still true that the zygote, which is a new cell, came from pre-existing cells, the gametes themselves. And by the way, once that fusion happens, that zygote doesn't last as a single-celled zygote very long. It soon then splits into two cells, and that is the beginning of the embryo, and then fetus, and then baby. All right, slide 8. We're looking at a little piece of DNA in this figure, and that's the most famous molecule in the world nowadays, but we haven't really known much about it for almost all of human history. And it's going to seem a long time ago that we learned about it in your young lives, but in terms of how long we've been thinking as humans, it's only recently that we even knew at all what DNA is. Now everyone, without even having taken a biology course, knows about DNA. Well, we'll study DNA in detail. As a matter of fact, an entire half of the semester is about DNA. The second half of the course is about DNA one way or another. So we'll talk about the details later, but for now, let me just tell you that DNA is an example of a nucleic acid. Nucleic acids make up one of four categories of biological macromolecules. Now, the word macromolecule simply means big molecule. And they're all tiny from our perspective, molecules that is. But compared to run-of-the-mill molecules like an oxygen molecule or a water molecule, macromolecules are much bigger. And all organisms that have ever existed are made up of the same four kinds or categories of biological macromolecules, which we'll study in detail in a different chapter as well. Nucleic acids is just one of those four. But since I'm mentioning it, does anyone know what the other three are?
Carbohydrates, lipids,
amylase. Close. And some people would even say you're correct, but let me tell you why I say those people are wrong. It's the carbohydrates one is technically not right. Carbohydrates is a huge group of molecules that we'll talk about later. But that huge group of carbohydrates includes both small molecules and big molecules. Glucose is a perfect example of a carbohydrate that is not a macromolecule. It's not big enough to be a macromolecule. It's a monosaccharide, a simple one-piece sugar that you could use if you hook it together with other monosaccharides to build a carbohydrate that is big. In other words, a macromolecular carbohydrate. And so if we're talking about the four categories of macromolecules, we should restrict our category names to those that are only large molecules, and that's not all of carbohydrates. Do you see what I'm saying here? Instead, the second or the next in the list of four categories is just the big or macromolecular carbohydrates, which we call polysaccharides. Okay, so that's another one. You're right about the other two, though. Proteins is another one, and lipids is the fourth. We'll talk about all of those in turn when we get to that chapter. Nucleic acids, though, is just one of them, and that's what DNA is. Why do we call them nucleic acids? Well, they're because they have acidic properties, but why do we call them nucleic? Right, because at least for eukaryotic cells, where you find the DNA is in the nucleus. That's why they were named that. Importantly, though, even prokaryotic cells have to have DNA for the same reasons that we have to have it. It's just that they don't have a nucleus. So the nucleus is not in its own the DNA in a prokaryotic cell is not in its own compartment. It's just part of the cytosol, our cytoplasm. It's not just randomly spread out, though. If I just temporarily go back to the picture in slide 6 of the prokaryotic cell, all of this stuff inside the cell for the prokaryotic cell is cytoplasm. The DNA is in there, but it's not membrane-bounded. It's just part of the cytoplasm. The region where it gets concentrated, though, is called the nucleoid, which you should be careful with. The oid ending means only like, right? Nucleoid means like a nucleus. It's not truly a nucleus because it's not enclosed by its own membrane. But anyway, importantly, the DNA that's in a prokaryotic cell is there for the same reason that it's in eukaryotic cells. Whether it's packaged into a nucleus or not doesn't really matter as far as the function of DNA is concerned, and I should say functions, because there are two major functions that DNA has in organisms in general. Now, one of those has to do with something that I started mentioning last time when I said that it's not true what we often say that DNA gives us our traits, right? I said that that's not directly true, I should say. Why is that not directly true? Right, it's the proteins of any given organism that actually directly give that organism its traits. But no organism is able to produce any kind of protein unless it has instructions for doing so. And those instructions originally are in the form of DNA. So the building of a protein, whatever it is really a two-step process. And we'll study these steps in the weeks ahead. Those are called transcription and translation. DNA is involved in only the first of these, which is transcription. And what happens is the information in DNA is used to build another kind of nucleic acid called RNA. DNA is done with the process at that point, but RNA is now carrying the information, and RNA then directly tells the cell how to assemble the protein, one little piece at a time. Without the DNA originally, though, there would be no proteins being possible to be made, and therefore no life. So the first of these two major functions that DNA has is transcription. And that is a process that really has to do with the lifetime of that cell, whether that cell is a whole organism or whether it's just part of a multicellular organism. A cell has a certain lifetime before it ends its life by splitting or just by being killed, right? And what it's using its DNA for during its lifetime is transcription as part of the protein synthesis process to make the proteins that are required for it to be alive. The second job, though, or function of DNA is really about what happens between generations when that cell gives rise to new cells. And that second function is replication, which means copying, right? So I'll get deeper into why this is true, but DNA has the remarkable property of serving as a template for how to build another copy of itself. So it's self-replication. DNA can tell the cell how to make another copy of that same DNA. And this is vitally important to life. We wouldn't be here without this fact, because getting back to the splitting of a cell into two new cells, if that's going to happen successfully, by which I mean if the two cells that are created when a cell splits are going to be viable, which means able to live, then they are going to have to be able to make all the same kinds of proteins that the original cell was able to make. Because if you can't make a protein that's necessary to live because you don't have the instructions for it, then you're going to die, right? So each of these two cells has to have the complete library of every instruction manual for how to build every kind of protein that the original cell had. We call that library, which is the combination of all the DNA in the organism, the genome. So what this means is that to make two viable cells out of one cell, that original cell, before splitting, has to copy its whole genome and temporarily have enough DNA for actually two cells before it can then split and give each of the two cells one complete library of DNA. Therefore, without this ability for DNA to replicate itself, you wouldn't have new cells arising from pre-existing cells. And the original cells would have just died. Right? No life would be here. Okay, let us go to 9 and talk a little bit about feedback mechanisms. Feedback mechanisms come in two varieties, as you can see in this slide. And those are called negative feedback and positive feedback. But one of these two feedback mechanisms is much more prevalent than the other. Negative feedback mechanisms vastly outnumber positive feedback mechanisms. Nearly all feedback mechanisms in biology are negative feedback mechanisms. And that's because only negative feedback mechanisms can lead to homeostasis or maintain homeostasis. Remember, we talked about homeostasis being the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment. In other words, keeping variables within tolerable limits is what homeostasis boils down to. Well, of the two feedback mechanisms, only negative feedback can ever do that. Positive feedback will never do that. So that's why most mechanisms are negative feedback. But let me just say in general that feedback involves some sort of variable, and it involves a set point. Now, a variable, by definition, is anything that can vary. So there's all kinds of different things that get controlled, variables that get controlled in cells, like pH, for instance. But temperature is a really easy to understand one, just by analogy with a room rather than a cell or anything having to do with biology. So maintenance of temperature is thermostasis. That's just an example of homeostasis. And to maintain room temperature, you use a thermostat, right? Named for the fact that it leads to thermostasis. Well, that involves a variable. In this case, the variable is temperature. Temperature is a variable because it's not constant. Its value can change. It can vary. But you also have a set point, which is what you set at the thermostat, right? That is a specific temperature that is desired, or that you want to actually be the value of the temperature overall. Notice, though, that no matter what set point you put into a thermostat, the room itself is almost never exactly at that temperature. Because the temperature is going to go up and down throughout the cycle, depending on whether it's being heated or cooled, right? And only when it actually crosses that line that represents the set point is it exactly equal to set point. It's usually either below or above to some degree. Does that make sense? Well, in other words, there's usually a difference, a mathematical difference between the value of the variable at the moment and the set point value. And we call that difference an error. So feedback mechanisms involve a variable, a set point, and an error. Notice that the error can be in either of two directions. Right? The temperature can be above the set point or it can be below the set point, but it's an error in both cases, just in different directions. Well, if you want to actually maintain temperature at or close to set point, what that's going to involve is reducing as much as possible or getting rid of the error. Whether it's an error because it's too high a temperature or too low. And another word for getting rid of is negate. To negate something means to get rid of it, right? This is exactly why negative feedback was called that. Negative is just the adjective of negate. So negative feedback operates by reducing the error, whatever the error is at the moment. And it's negative feedback that's used in both directions. So do not think that negative feedback works if the error is in one direction and positive feedback in the other direction. That's not true at all. It's negative feedback that's used in both situations. If the temperature gets too high, that's an error. And negative feedback will bring that temperature back down. It reduces that error. But if it's too low, negative feedback will bring it back up to reduce the error in the other direction. Positive feedback will never do that. Positive feedback is the opposite of negative feedback, and it therefore will make the error even worse than it is, even greater. It'll move the variable, in other words, even farther away from the set point than it was before the positive feedback mechanism operated. So it never leads to homeostasis. And this is why they're comparatively rare compared to negative feedback mechanisms, that is. There are plenty of examples of positive feedback in biology, but nearly every biology textbook uses the same example, which is parturition or childbirth. Whether it's childbirth or any other positive feedback mechanism, though, they are all temporary. They have to be temporary. Either they're temporary because you will die, which is you're only living temporarily, or they're temporary because after they operate, negative feedback mechanisms will come into play and restore homeostasis. But let's just use this classic example of childbirth. What happens here is... And think about this in a way to make sense of why it's positive feedback. What happens, though, close to labor, is that the fetus, which is usually upside down from our point of view in the uterus, that the head of that fetus is at the cervix of the uterus, the neck, or narrowing. And so it starts stretching that narrow cervix, the head does. Well, neurons in the cervix sense that stretching, send signals to the brain, and the brain responds by releasing oxytocin, which is a hormone. Hormones, by definition, get delivered into the bloodstream, so the whole body will receive that oxytocin signal, but most of the body ignores it because they don't have the signals to receive it. They don't know the oxytocin's there. But the uterus does. It has receptors for the oxytocin, and the uterus responds to that by having the blind end, or the fundus, the part where the feet are, of the uterus squeeze. That pushes the fetus closer to the vagina through the cervix, and that makes the stretch even more drastic, right? So it's building, it's increasing the error, in a sense. The error here is that I don't want to be stretched, but it's getting worse. And so that sends an even stronger signal to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, which travels back through the bloodstream to the uterus and causing even more contracting, which pushes it even farther into the cervix, making stretch even more, so it keeps building. And that's a temporary mechanism, right? Either the woman dies, or the kid pops out, and then negative feedback mechanisms will restore homeostasis. But you could also think about a pathological example, like losing a limb and it having it cut off for whatever reason. If that happens, there's going to be a lot of blood loss, right? And so the body is going to respond to that loss of blood, or that reduction in blood pressure, by trying to get the blood pressure back up, by making the heart beat faster and stronger. Well, that's just going to gush more blood out, which is going to reduce the blood pressure even more, and it's just a vicious cycle. So that would be a temporary one that results in death unless someone intervenes. Okay. Let's go to 10. Here we have a pictorial representation of classification of organisms, putting them in categories, basically, because we like to have things nice and ordered. This is taxonomy. Classification is taxonomy. But notice the taxon part of that word. Taxon is just a general word that means a group. And the plural of taxon, by the way, is taxa, not taxons. But anyway, it's a real general word. Each of these listings at the top is a taxon. It's a group of some size. And that's why we call this scheme taxonomy. But this is another hierarchy, just like the hierarchy of biological organization from atoms up to the biosphere. Classification is hierarchical. For instance, class here, that's one taxon. It's hierarchical because it contains, as a big group, smaller groups within it called orders. It has some number of orders in it, and each order has some number of families and so on. So you have likely heard of the taxa called kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. Have you been taught that ever? Or have you at least... You've heard of some of them, probably, at least. Genus and species you've probably heard of. Well, we've been classifying organisms for millennia. But we've been doing it throughout most human history, we've been doing it basically on just how these things outwardly look to us, which isn't really have anything to do with their relatedness. But anyway, early on, before me, there were just two kingdoms, plants and animals. We lumped everything either as a plant or an animal. Of course, there's many other kinds of organisms we know now. The point is, though, the kingdoms were the biggest groups, the biggest taxa originally, and there were only two of them. By the time I existed and was in fifth grade or so, it was still true that kingdoms were the biggest taxa, but there were by then five of them. Nothing bigger than kingdoms, though. Well, nowadays, there's many more than five kingdoms, plus kingdoms are not even the biggest groups anymore. As you see here, even bigger than kingdoms, you have taxa that are called domains. And domains, for the time being, are the biggest, most inclusive taxa, meaning they include the biggest number of things. They're the biggest group in the hierarchy. And there are exactly three domains. Each domain contains a certain number of kingdoms. Each kingdom has a certain number of phyla in it, and so on down the line, all the way to genus and species, which are often lumped together, but they're separate taxa. Genus is one taxon, species is another. Now for humans, as we're using bears here as an example. Well, let's just use bears as an example since it's already written. Notice that we often refer to organisms by the so-called scientific name, which can also be called the binomial. Binomial literally just means two names. A binomial is really just a listing of that organism's genus, the genus it belongs to, followed by the name of the species it belongs to. So, Ursus americanus is not the species. Ursus is the genus, americanus is the species. And similarly for humans, Homo sapiens is not our species name. Sapiens is the species. That species belongs to a bigger group called the genus, which has the name Homo. And that used to include several species. Everyone but us has gone extinct. And we're on our way out now, too. So there probably won't be any Homo left. But anyway, a so-called binomial or scientific name is really just the genus listed before the species name. And there's a correct way of doing this, which is why the example is shown here. You should always, if you're using a binomial, italicize both the genus and the species name. You should always capitalize the genus name. You should never capitalize the species name, just like this. And similarly for Homo sapiens, Homo is italicized and capitalized. Sapiens is italicized but not capitalized. Well, speaking of domains, slide 11 shows you the three that I told you that exist. Now we can give names to them. Notice that one of these, the bottom one, the one that we belong to, is called Eukarya. And you probably already guessed why it's got that name. The domain Eukarya is made up of all the eukaryotic organisms, or the eukaryotes, and only the eukaryotes. So every eukaryotic organism that has ever existed belongs to this domain, and that's the only thing in that domain. Well, there's three domains, as we see here, but I just got done telling you that there's a dichotomy of cell type. There's two cell types, but three domains. One of the domains corresponds to a cell type, eukarya. But notice that there is no domain called prokarya. So if you are not a eukaryote, you're not a member of this domain, but that means by definition you're a prokaryote, because that's the only two types of cells there are, right? And the point here is that the prokaryotes of the world aren't in one domain. They're split into two domains, which are bacteria and archaea. And it's pretty easy to guess what belongs to the domain bacteria. It's all of the bacteria and only the bacteria. They're not the only prokaryotes of the world, though, bacteria. They're the most prevalent. By far, most organisms alive today, and by far, most organisms that have ever lived are bacteria. But there are other prokaryotic cells, or prokaryotic organisms, and they are members of the other prokaryotic order called archaea, the members of which are archaeans. Now, if you were to put a bacterium and an archaean side by side on a light microscope and look at them, you really wouldn't be able to tell me any difference between them. So outwardly, they look pretty similar. But there are very important molecular differences that tell us that they went down separate evolutionary trajectories. And what might be surprising to you, or at least interesting, is that Archaeans are actually evolutionarily closer to us eukaryotes than either of us is to bacteria in the overall tree of life. All right, now to 12. This has a little bit to do with evolution as well. We're looking here at two cilia, which means hairs. Singular is cilium. They're not actually hair. True hair is made only by mammals, and it's macroscopic. These are microscopic little hair-like appendages coming off the surface of cells. Some cells are ciliated, some are not, including in your own body. The right side in blue is a cilium from an endothelial cell lining the interior of the trachea. The pink one on the left is a cilium on a cell that is a unicellular organism called a paramecium. Now, these are not very closely related organisms, right? Humans and paramecia. Of course, if you want to go back to the original cells, everything is related if you go back far enough. But these are pretty distantly related. Despite that distant relation, though, the architecture molecularly of the cilia in these two distant relatives is almost identical. And in fact, things like this are how we have evidence for the fact that we all came from a common ancestor, those original successful cells. The fact that there are such distant relatives that still have such similarity of structure in their cilia really tells you that whenever this happened accidentally, which is how new things come about, just accidentally by DNA mutation, that actually happened to be a very successful accident. It was so successful that further evolution really hasn't changed it. Because you'd have to make it even better accidentally than it already is, and it's working pretty perfectly as it is. But it happened a long time ago. That's why, after a lot of divergence and speciation, you still have the tips of the trees far away from each other, very similar to each other. I'm using trees as an analogy, but we'll look at a phylogenetic tree in a minute. First, let's go to 13, which also has a little bit to do with evolution, and more specifically, the kind of evolution that can lead to an increase in adaptation. What kind of evolution is that, or what is the mechanism? What is it? No, I gave you a term that said that it's what Darwin's famous for. Natural selection, yes. Natural selection is the kind of evolution that will increase fitness or adaptation in a population over generations. And there's countless examples of this, but this is just one easy to understand one, especially because humans are so visually oriented and it's based on vision. So you have two different populations here, a prey population, the bugs, and a predator population, the birds. The birds, let me start with the prey. The insects here are all the same species, but they're in a population. Within any given naturally occurring population, individuals vary in their traits, right? It's not the case that every individual in a population is identical. There are different traits, just like for us in this classroom. And the traits could be just about anything, but here we're just restricting our attention to a specific trait, which is coloration. Notice that some of the individuals are darker and some of them are lighter colored. And notice that it is a dark background in these pictures, these cartoons. Well, that represents the environment in which they live. The substrate or the thing that they live on, whatever it is dark. Now, the predator, the bird, doesn't care about any of this. It just wants to eat as many insects as possible so that it will take in enough energy and hopefully it will live long enough to be able to reproduce, right? But it doesn't care about any of that. It just wants to eat. And It doesn't really have a preference for dark or light insects. It will gladly eat either one. It just doesn't want to spend time looking for a certain one, right? It's going to eat whatever it sees move. And therefore, it's going to, more often than not, eat an individual that contrasts starkly with the background. In this case, the light-colored individuals. They really stand out against the dark background. Now, they were just, they're light for random reasons, because they got dealt that genetic hand, right? But in this particular environment, lightness is a detriment. And that's why the light-colored ones aren't going to be as likely to survive being eaten long enough for them to pass their DNA on to the next generation of insects. In other words, to pass on the DNA corresponding to light-coloredness. Whereas the dark-colored ones will, yeah, some of them will be eaten, but many of them will elude the predator by hiding in the background, live long enough to give rise to more dark-colored individuals, and therefore the next generation of bugs will be more dark as an average than light. That is, by definition, natural selection. It's an example of natural selection. Okay, and there's a famous example of this that happened a couple hundred years ago after we started the Industrial Revolution. This was in Europe. But it's actually the opposite case of this. There were bugs that were living on trees, but the advantage was to be light because the bark was light. And so most of them in the population were light. The dark ones that would appear would quickly be eaten. But then the Industrial Revolution came and we burnt so much coal, creating so much soot, that the tree barks were just blackened. And that's a change in the environment and therefore a change in the selection pressure. Now natural selection is going to operate the opposite way since the environment changed. And the ones that were light were all of a sudden stood out. And they were quickly eaten, and the few previously unlucky dark ones are now the lucky ones. They survived, and the population turned darker by natural selection. Fourteen is that example of a phylogenetic tree I told you I would give. Phylogeny is a type of classification. I said a little bit earlier that throughout most of our history, we were classifying things basically on how they look to us. Well, these two things look similar, they must be related. Well, that's not necessarily true. So phylogeny is not about grouping things based on how they look to humans. It's grouping things together based on their shared ancestry, on the flow of DNA from ancestors. And that's why we have these tree-like arrangements in phylogeny. Now this one just happens to be a tiny section of the overall tree of life. You could build an enormously big and complex tree of life with a lot of branches, but still one common ancestor, the original successful cells, that would be the trunk of the tree, right? And that's what I keep talking about when I say all living organisms descended from those original living cells. We're all related that way. But then each split or bifurcation of a lineage represents speciation, creation of new species because populations diverge for various reasons. And that's a 182 concern, so I'll let you study that in greater detail in 182. But these kinds of trees, tree-like structures, are called phylogenetic trees. All right, 15 now. This has to do with the scientific method, which has steps that you've probably studied before. But I want to go through these, especially because a lot of students confuse two of the parts of this. But really, this all starts with the fact that humans notice things about the world. They make observations. And so that's just something by itself. We notice things. But since we are curious individuals by nature, we don't just accept our observations, and we are curious, so we wonder why things are that way. We notice that things are that way. We want to explain why they're that way. And so that's the question part. Observations naturally lead to questions about why things are that way. Well, then you get to the part that students confuse, which are hypotheses and predictions. They are not the same thing, and I see them switched all the time in students. Questions naturally lead to hypotheses because hypotheses are explanations. And linguistically, hypotheses are declarative statements stated in such a way that the hypothesis is the truth, whether it is the truth or not. But you state a hypothesis as though it were true. It's a declarative statement saying, more or less, things are this way because such and such. Because is a big word to tell you that it's a hypothesis. Right? It's an explanation, so it makes sense that it would have the word because in it. It doesn't say anything about what will happen. That future tense tells you that would be a prediction, right? But hypotheses naturally lead to predictions, logically, I should say, lead to predictions. The hypothesis, which is an explanation for something, corresponds to a prediction, which is really just telling you what would happen if that hypothesis actually were true. Now, when you state the hypothesis, you pretend it's true, even though it might not be, and then that leads up to a logical prediction of what would happen if it actually were true. But linguistically, a prediction will have words like will in it rather than because, right? You'll say in a prediction, if such and such hypothesis is true and you do this, then this should happen or will happen. And that is hopefully clarified with this easy to understand example of the broken or the non-functioning flashlight. That's the observation. She's asking the question, why does this not work? Well, there's not just two possible hypotheses here. There's any number of possible hypotheses, but each one is an explanation. In other words, this hypothesis explains the problem. It says the light doesn't work because the battery's dead. The other competing hypothesis, the light doesn't work because it has a burnout bulb. Well, each one individually leads to its own prediction. If it's true that the battery's dead, then switching out the batteries will solve the problem and the light will light. Similarly for the changing out the light bulb, right? You see the difference between hypothesis and prediction? Okay. Well, just like hypotheses naturally lead to predictions, predictions lead to tests. If you have a prediction, then you can actually undergo something that will see whether that prediction comes true. And that, called a test here, is also called an experiment. That is where the science actually comes in. Science or experimentation, which is an important part of science, it's the basis of the scientific method in science, is experimentation is just a way of testing whether predictions that correspond to hypotheses will actually come true. You can't, I mean, it shouldn't be satisfying in the process to just come up with a prediction and leave it at that, right? You naturally want to be able to see whether that prediction will come true. That's what the science part is, the experimentation part. So she went ahead for hypothesis one and changed the battery. It didn't solve the problem. So if a prediction does not come true after experimentation, that tells us that hypothesis is incorrect. Even though you state it as though it's correct, it is proven to be incorrect. Now, it's at least partially incorrect. It might be able to be tweakable, in which case you would not only modify the hypothesis, but you would modify the prediction that comes from it, and you would therefore modify the test. So it might not be totally ridiculous, but at least as stated, it's incorrect. You've proven that. What happens if the light goes on, though, like in the second hypothesis test? What does that tell you? It doesn't. We can't really prove hypotheses. We can support them. So what a prediction coming true tells us is that the corresponding hypothesis might be correct. And an easy way to understand this in this example is that maybe the whole problem all along was a discontinuity in the wire, just a loose wire. And what she did was unscrew the bulb, which is good, replace it with another good bulb, but in the process, jiggled it in such a way that the wire is now connected again. Right? That gives you the impression that the hypothesis is true because the prediction came true, but it doesn't necessarily prove it. This is exactly why we don't rely on one test. Science has repeated testing. And as a matter of fact, the things that we call facts, which are never really absolutely proven, are simply the things that stand up over and over to repeated testing with the prediction always coming true. And those include things like gravity. Now, you can keep testing this, but I bet you that dropping this, it's not going to make it go upward. Right? It's going to go toward the Earth. Natural selection, or evolution by natural selection, another fact. What we call facts change, though. Because if we do test it in a different way and it suddenly comes out to not be true, then we have to, as scientists, reject what we called a fact before. And this brings up a fundamental difference between faith and science, which are drastically different ways of looking at the world. They're both beliefs, but faith is belief that isn't based on evidence. You can have whatever reason you want to believe via faith. Not only is it belief in the absence of evidence, it's even belief sometimes despite presence of evidence to the contrary. In other words, you're just choosing to believe it. You don't care whether there's evidence or whether the evidence contradicts what you're believing. That's drastically different from science. Science is belief based on evidence, and if further testing shows that the evidence is not there, then you're no longer acting scientifically if you continue to believe that. For instance, Newtonian mechanics, explaining how things move in the universe, is not fact. We called it fact for a while until we realized, well, actually, when you get down to the microscopic level, this stuff breaks down mathematically. It's not true. It seems true because it's very close in macroscopic terms, which is why we still bother to teach it, even though it's not fact. But it's been supplanted by quantum mechanics, which is the new truth. So truths are simply what we have more and more evidence for without failing. And that changes scientifically. I think that's the end of that chapter. What are we looking at? Well, there's time to start. I won't get very deeply into it.